I wanted to ask whether all of the 170 odd detainees now have volunteer lawyers.
No, the answer is some do not, because some have, for reasons that are just utterly mysterious, some have lost faith in the process and have chosen not to participate and have not filed petitions for habeas corpus. There are, that doesn't represent very many. I should say, because Len and I both didn't say it, over half the people there have been, there have been task forces created by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration that looked at all the available evidence, classified, non-classified, everything that's in the government's possession about the risk of releasing this person. And over half the people there have been cleared for transfer by both administrations.
Thank you very much for coming. I really enjoy that. There seems to be this growing tendency for all these types of events like Guantanamo and such to be sort of test runs for what may happen on the domestic population here. You talk about the NDAA. We know that the White House establishment showed their hand where you know, things that you see on this screen are actually really for U.S. citizens, and that can take place domestically here. My question is, with this sort of gradual creeping of these kind of legal injustices or foreign tribunals and such, in the academic legal community, is there a consensus against this development, awareness of this development, or is there a gradual among professors in the legal community rubber stamping this kind of thing? Because we know that the legal profession is basically our vanguard to sort through all the technicalities of these processes and things, and they can be a great defender of our liberties, and they can also rubber stamp these types of injustices. So I just want to get your opinion if the academic legal community is shifting towards supporting this development or if they're against this.
You know, I would say that if the academic legal community is the, you know, the last defense or the bulwark against totalitarianism, then we're all screwed. So that's not the person, that's not the group into whom you want to repose your trust. Having said that, the legal community, the legal academic community, which is very different than the legal community, is profoundly opposed to most of the things that are happening. I mean, the post 9/11 response in legal academia has been an almost unanimous chorus of condemnation. The interesting thing that's happened, however, and this is, I hope I have time to expound on this, the very, very interesting thing is that the great myth, as I said before, is that we're most apt to make our worst mistakes immediately after the incident that gives rise to our sense of threat, right? And then we do bad things, and we gradually get better, and we correct it, and we view ourselves as having, you know, regained our course. That's the myth. And everybody invokes things like, you know, the internment of the Japanese, right, which we regret after the war. What's really important to understand is that's not what happened post 9/11. In fact, these conditions now are in many respects, the sort of conversation in the public square is much worse than it was right after 9/11. And there are complicated reasons for this. But what was just passed in the NDAA, and people like Rick Santorum and the things that he can say, and Herman Cain, and, you know, just the stuff you hear on GOP debates, you literally never, ever could have heard that except in internet chat rooms and Rush Limbaugh. You never could have heard that in mainstream credible press immediately after 9/11. It's vastly worse now, even though the threat level is vastly diminished. And so the question of who's at the vanguard and how the trends are moving is much more complicated than the myth sort of lets you, encourages you to believe.
I'm close to this question, but slightly different point of view. I see the Constitution of the United States as being totally trashed. And part of the total trashing comes from the White House. I don't understand it because the president was a constitutional teacher. We are now living at a time, and I don't need to lecture to you guys about this, where so much about our Constitution and the rights that individuals have is being destroyed. Now, you came on first by saying thank you for being involved. How long, what do all of us have to do to start a massive, not just the 99% group, but a massive protest to save, literally save this democracy? What do we have to do?
Do you want to?
No. I wish I had an answer. I mean, I spoke earlier today and I mentioned, you know, one thing that I think is important, that there's only one presidential candidate that has talked about in the Constitution, and that is that we should go back to the requirement that Congress declare war before we invade another country, because these undeclared wars have, with no end, have allowed the government carte blanche to do some of the things that you described. So,
all right, thanks for coming. I take your point about the Constitution and form and substance, and in line with some of the other comments that have been made, I'd like to broaden the discussion. Many of us here in the Occupy Movement and Peace Movement are looking forward to NATO G8, not just new NDAA movements in the past, but when I was at Washington Tribunal, I was thinking instead of those three people. The three people sitting there would be Rahm Emanuel, Eric Holder, and Barack Obama, ruling on us if we violate the new statutes that are being put forward for NATO G8 here in the city of Chicago. I'm picking up on Leanne's comments. This is not just about Guantanamo, it's about Bagram, the other secret black sites. 50% of young black males who have been, are, or will be in jail.
Your question, please?
Comment on my comment and observations about this not just being Guantanamo, not just being NDAA, but more generally potentially affecting all of us here.
Do you want to, or do you want me to?
So this is what I spend all my time thinking about and writing about. Because if I just, you know, did work like what Len does all the time, I'd jump off a bridge. So as respite, shelter from the storm, I focus on the fact that the things that you point out, I got to find a better hobby. But what you are describing is a consequence of what the broader trend in American thought that represents the end of New Deal liberalism and the Great Society of Johnson, which is the last moment that there was any sort of sense of communitarian spirit, and the rise of modern conservatism and then what that represents in the triumph of radical individualism. That's the broadly what has allowed a lot of this to happen, very, very broadly. And what that shift has allowed and encouraged is a balkanization of society and the repeated identifications of the demons in society that are truly responsible for bad things happening. And they're juvenile super predators, gangbangers, they're welfare queens, they're whatever the trope du jour is of the people who are most responsible for making our worlds perilous. Immigrants, you know, Mexicans, and now in a post 9/11 world, it's a variation of something else. It's Islam, it's Arabs, it's something else. It's all the same thing. It's all the same phenomenon. And the difference between the perspective that your question has and the perspective that your question has is that you conceive the country broadly as a collection of us, whereas the dominant perspective now perceives the country in a more brittle, narrow way that is endangered by a collection of thems. And if you conceive the country that way and you go after them, you don't think that the Constitution's being shredded because you genuinely believe that thems aren't entitled to and are not the people for whom the Constitution is meant to protect. And so if you view it as an embrace of we, the people, as opposed to us but not them people, then you have a very, very different perspective on the right way to behave. So what you are really asking is, how do you create a more communitarian spirit, a sense of civic virtue that embraces the north side of Evanston and the south side of Evanston, the north side of Chicago and the south side of Chicago? And that is an extraordinarily difficult challenge. It cannot, the evidence of how difficult it is that a president like President Obama, who, though a centrist, never, ever really a great liberal, but who believes fundamentally in this broader community, retreats from it in the face of the most modest political pressure by what was then a substantial minority party. Right? So all you have to do is stand up and say the what are now the conservative tropes, and they are so overwhelmingly accepted in society that even a president who is inclined to take a communitarian, broader perspective retreats instantly at the direction of our, or their, current mayor.
So I think these are some great questions, and I just want to jump in and answer the question my way, which is the thing that people can do is get into the streets. And I personally had, you know, sort of a come to Jesus moment around this to understand that the reason to get into the streets is because that's where the other people are, and that's how you get to meet with your fellows and talk and work out what we need to do together. And so one of the worst things about these obstacles or these denials of civil liberties are that they frustrate our getting into the streets. They say, stay in your home. Whatever you do, do not get out there in the street with your fellow members of this community. So I think of the word streets. And then I want to ask you to think about another word, which is delegate. So much of our modern life is built around the idea that we delegate certain things to other people. Every 4 years, we delegate the leadership of our country to the person we vote for. We can delegate thinking about these problems to experts. We can delegate this to, you know, our attorneys. And we're very fortunate to have great experts who really do these things for us, but also at the end of the day, I think every time we think the word, I'm going to leave that to so-and-so, I'm going to delegate that to so-and-so, we should challenge ourselves and say, no, wait a minute. I'm the candidate. I'm the expert. I'm the activist. So,
for your time and everything for coming in today, I'm a USA veteran, and I was an Army contractor, too, in Kuwait for 5 years. I want to ask a really important question. Realistically, what are the solutions then on the upper hierarchy level of government to provide solutions for these horrible things and acts that's happening, and also to make people accountable for their actions, like organizations like the CIA that doesn't listen to anyone, and organizations like the FBI? So what are the solutions to some of these problems? If you guys can answer some of that question right there, appreciate it. Thank you.
I might be a little more cynical than Joe, and you know, when I look at Barack Obama and the modern Democratic Party, I see two political parties that are looking for political contributions from the same industries, the defense industry, from Wall Street, And as long as those people feel that they own Washington, D.C., and that's why, you know, I love the Occupy movement. I love the fact that people are getting in the streets and saying, you know, we want our government back because they've sold us out. And I don't know what the solution is. If it's, you know, how do you get money out of politics? I don't know how to do it. Maybe Joe has an idea.
Question going back to the legal status on Guantanamo. How far away are we from eliminating enemy combatant classification and going back to prisoner of war and civilian classifications? And what are the prospects for actually suing all these people who denied due process and detained these people for so long?
We are farther away from that now than we were right after 9/11. It is more firmly entrenched. It is the word that is so popular now is to say normalized. It enjoys the overwhelming support of political leaders and now rolls trippingly off the tongue of most press folks. So. The idea of reconceiving the identity of, and labels are very important, words are very important, and relabeling them as something other than enemy combatants is functionally impossible in the immediate term. However, the hope that something like that will happen is infinitely greater than the hope that there will be accountability measures, that there will be ever any, and ever is what I mean, formal mechanisms that impose some consequences on people who may have engaged in creating these policies. I have to confess, I am not a fan, for instance, of criminal trials for anybody. I've always been a believer in sort of a truth and reconciliation commission where everything is made public. Everything is just made public, and you let the public square have it out. That's my answer to the question, well, how's it going to get better? It's related to Joe's. You've just got to participate in the public square, which is why I always come to these things. But in the immediate term, that's simply not going to happen, as I said, because for complicated reasons, the space for, that is the physical or the metaphorical space in the public square for the message about Guantanamo is fundamentally different than it was. People have to recall, it changes so quickly and it becomes so thorough and so hegemonic that you lose sight of the fact. But at the time of the 2008 elections, Everybody, including the American public in polls, wanted to close Guantanamo, thought it was a good idea to close Guantanamo. The only person who didn't among the Republican candidates at the time, you know, during the debates, was Mitt Romney, who said, I don't want to close it, I want to double it. And everybody scorned him as out of touch and a radical and a nut job. And no one can say that now. And it changed like that on a dime in, you know, February, March of 2009. And how and why that happened is a really very interesting story, but it set in, and you got to blame Obama for not pushing back against that, but it set in motion a tone that's vastly more vindictive and punitive than we had in 2006, 2007, 2008.
It's hard to know where to begin, but I think everybody in this room is aware that we're moving to be a police state. I think it was Ray McGovern who said, someone told him, oh, pretty soon we'll be a police state. And he said, oh, thank God, I thought we already were. The government is militarizing our police forces, our local police forces, big time. And true, we need to get into the streets. but it's going to be dangerous. It's going to be rough. I'm not saying we shouldn't. I think we have to, or we'll lose it. But I'm wondering, where are the kids? One thing we can do, as mostly seniors, is explain to our children and grandchildren what the heck is going on before it's too late. And thanks to you guys.
Isn't it true that we actually have abrogated the Bill of Rights as of December 31st, when Obama signed into law this National Defense Authorization Act, the part of it, of course, which is every American citizen can be detained without trial of a jury or without having any lawyer available, taken off the streets and detained for an indefinite period of time. Now, to me, we're in a communist country because I've studied communism, and this is what has happened in most of their countries. That's what their citizens can expect. What can we do to reverse this legally as fast as we can? You say it's a climate. I don't want to wait for the climate to change. I want to find out what we can actually do legally to overturn what has just happened to America.
Do you want to jump in, or do you want me to?
Whoever has the answer,
Immediately, the answer to your question is there's nothing you can do, because you can't challenge a law until it is invoked against someone. And as long as it's not invoked against anyone, it exists only as a specter. It is the sword of Damocles that hangs over you. Once it is invoked and a U.S. citizen is taken into custody and not given criminal process, then, courtesy of this law, then it can be challenged. I have to tell you, however, because I really believe that there's enough, I'm not saying that you are being bombastic, but there is enough bombast out there that it behooves us to be careful in what we say. Why? Because I think the truth is worth pursuing. What the law says is that it does not purport to change existing law with respect to the rights of U.S. citizens. And therefore, it is not evident that a U.S. citizen in this country could be picked up and not given a trial. That has never been tested. The closest that came is when Jose Padilla landed in this country from overseas and was picked up here in Chicago and held as, and he's a U.S., is a U.S. citizen, and was held as an enemy combatant in Virginia and then South Carolina. Before that, the ultimate constitutionality of that decision not to prosecute him could be tested, they took him, the U.S. government took him out of that detention and prosecuted him. But what they haven't done is pick up someone, a U.S. citizen, in this country, here based on conduct, and he's always been here, and he's here lawfully, and it's based on conduct that they're describing that took place here, and then try to make him an enemy combatant and not prosecute him. We don't know whether there's if there's five votes to say that's okay, then it's lawful. If there's only four votes that say it's okay, then it's not lawful. And we don't know that yet. So the status of the Bill of Rights is in peril. The status of the Bill of Rights is in doubt. And the answer to that in the immediate term is an engagement in the public square. I have to say, and this is responsive also to my friend's question out here, do not look to the legal community as your savior. That ain't what we are. That's not what we are. You all are the savior and your children.
I'd like to know a little bit more about WikiLeaks and the role that they play and your opinion about the Bradley Manning case.
Do you
want to? Yeah, I, you know, my, Well, there were a number of WikiLeaks releases. The one that I referred to in my talk was the release of the Guantanamo files. All of the releases have been significant. In my view, in my view, one of the really saddest parts of this Guantanamo work, I have a friend who's a federal judge, and I tell her about my case, and she's shocked. She can't believe it, that this is going on. And the reason why people, even a learned federal judge, doesn't know is because everything is closed to the public. All of our hearings are, they lock the doors, they take away our cell phones, there's no reporters in there. My client testified at his habeas hearing, there was no reporter to see him testify, to see the sad, frustrated face of a person that's been locked up for 9 years without being charged. And to me, things like WikiLeaks independent media are so important, because if people don't know, if this can be done in the dark of night, that's why executions are committed, in the middle of night, why we no longer get to see dead bodies come back from war. So if you don't see it, then if it's not on the news, people, it's harder for people to get upset.
I may be naive, misinformed, or ill-informed, but I never quite understand this issue of Guantanamo. If what happens at Guantanamo would be what would happen in the United States, it seems like a distinction without a difference to me. If you eliminate Guantanamo, you still have 170-odd people there who have to be incarcerated somewhere else. So what is the difference?
Oh, I've always agreed with that. I've always said that the question is not where you hold them, it's how you hold them. So people want to bring them to Thompson, Illinois. That, by the way, is completely off the table politically, but I've never really attached that much significance to that. The only difference would be it'd be much easier for me and Len to go visit our clients. So it's what matters is how you hold them and how the model you create by virtue of having something called Guantanamo replicates itself elsewhere, right? How it becomes a model for other kinds of detention and other kind of practices for other sort of people, that's vastly more important than where it is.
I'm gonna take the opportunity to add a comment, which is really a way of asking Joe a question. One of the things I tell people is pay close attention to this notion of an unlawful enemy combatant, which is put forward in these combatant status review tribunals. What it says is there's a body of law that deals with civilians, civil law, and there's a body of law that deals with combatants or soldiers, and that's military law. And what has been created is an in-between category of people who don't have a status. So they're neither fish nor fowl. There is not a body of law that applies to them, and therefore the way in which the process that they are treated with is made up step by step. And I was very struck when I read the book The Dark Side by Jane Mayer. She makes the point that under the Geneva Conventions, there is no such thing as a person who does not have a status. So the idea that you've created people without status is a horrible, horrible fiction. And Joe alluded to this a little bit. So one of the things that I say to people is the 171 people who remain at Guantanamo are but the tip of the iceberg of the number of people being held in detention through in the course of our military interventions. So think about Bagram, think about the rest of the places in Afghanistan where detainees are being held. And I'll start by saying that one of the previous times we screened this film, one of the people on the panel was a retired Air Force general who was at the time the head of the International Humanitarian Law Institute at DePaul. And he said, don't just think about Guantanamo, think about Bagram, think about the rest of Afghanistan. So at lunch with him, I said, well, how many people is the United States holding in Afghanistan? He said, well, you know, it's about 500 people, but you're asking me the wrong question. Well, what's the right question? Ask how many people are being held on our say-so by others, especially the Afghan government. We said, well, how many is that? And he said, well, it's a very vast number. And since then, I've tried to do a little research. And because it's a secret, it can only be estimated. But, I'm looking to find good numbers on that. We often say the 171 people, maybe that's 1% or 2% of the people who are being held in this in-between limbo state. So maybe 10,000, 15,000 people. Now, I have the opportunity to ask somebody who actually can be very specific about the accuracy of that in terms of status. Is that correct, that the people in Afghanistan are also being held?
Oh, yeah. But I, again, this is like a ball of mercury, right? And you try to put your finger on it and it slips out somewhere else. The post 9/11 practices of the United States have changed, and it's like an organic thing that learns and responds to pressure and becomes more sophisticated. And the United States is not doing wholesale big detentions anymore. Why? Because that's much more difficult to conceal. It's much more difficult. It requires much more of an infrastructure. You know, to build a big prison at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan is a big deal, and it attracts attention. And so it's much better to outsource it. So we're outsourcing many, many more, and to regionalize it. So it used to be that we'd pick somebody up in the Horn of Africa, and you'd fly them to Bagram. Well, that's silly, because it invites scrutiny, because you got a contract to have a plane. And when you contract to have a plane, you got a contract to have a pilot, and you got a contract to have people refuel it, and you got to get approval for flying over airspace. And sometimes you land in a NATO country just to refuel on your way from, you know, Tanzania to Kabul, and then on to Well, that leaves a paper trail that eventually creative NGO organizations and journalists track down. And then there's a bunch of bad press. So why don't we just keep them in Tanzania? And why don't we train the Tanzanians and the Ugandans and the Kenyans and the Somalis and the Ethiopians? Because nobody's going there. And if they're held by Ethiopians, well, I don't know. It's just they're held because they violated an Ethiopian law. Are they our prisoner or are they their prisoner? That's a much more sophisticated response than, well, let's just schlep them all to Guantanamo. As long as we get access to them so that we can conduct interrogations or monitor interrogations that other people do, and nobody's going to complain about prison conditions there, because prison conditions for everybody are bad, right? Because there's no infrastructure and there's no money for good conditions. So that, from their perspective, is a vastly superior. That's what's happening now. How do you handle that? What are you going to do? You're going to file a habeas action against somebody who's held in Somalia by a Somali court? Where are you going to go for that? And he's a foreign national, and you're going to file that in the United States? Okay, good luck with that. So that's much more difficult. That's where we're going. Guantanamo's a sideshow now compared to what's happening. How's that for cheery news?
Not very cheery.
Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Following up on the international here. How much support do you get from the international community, and are they in cahoots because of these various things?
Well, that's another thing that's...
And in Cuba, right. For Guantanamo, what is our relationship there with the...
Well, so our relationship to Cuba is a different thing that relates to the whole history of the base, and, one of the clever stories about this is that, Castro has said, leave, your presence here is not welcome, and the United States ignores him. And the United States, pursuant to the terms of a lease that's over a century old now, we pay rent. We actually rent space there pursuant to a lease that runs in perpetuity as long as we want. And so we send him a rent check every year. It's true. We send him a rent check every year, which he returns on cash. So it's this game. Yeah.
So it has its own water supply, power supply. It's self-sustaining. But you ask a very interesting question. What is the international community? Well, the international community is vast. And so, you know, so Europe, for instance, is over most of Europe, most of the Islamic world, but again, you don't want to be monolithic about these things, is overwhelmingly opposed to U.S. post 9/11 practices. But, you know, like, for instance, in Ethiopia, these are the regimes there are extremely solicitous of the approval of the United States government and the aid that comes with it. This is part of an aid package, right? It's part of an aid package. It's part of an infrastructure package. You build your infrastructure. We'll pay for roads. We'll pay for power plants. We'll pay for electricity. We'll pay for your prison. So the governments there are very enthusiastic about it.
I'd like to speak just briefly to the campaign to close Guantanamo as a metaphor for the kinds of things we've been talking about today. I've been wearing my orange shirt for the last week, and I'm going to be wearing it until after the 11th. And I'd like to ask Joe to maybe summarize what's going to be happening in the Chicago area in the next 4 or 5 days. It's going to be an incredibly active week. I think most of you know Obama is coming here for a huge fundraiser with his big money people. The anti-torture resolution is going to be introduced in the city of Chicago, and all the Guantanamo people have been making these connections all the time. Just one little brief thing before I ask Joe to summarize what's happening, where the events are. There's vigils every day from now till the 11th when there'll be a direct action. In the 50s, a group of people refused to take shelter when everybody in the United States went in the basement for some phony drill to save us from atomic bombs. I remember getting under the table. Doesn't save you from a nuclear attack. In the 60s, a small group of people eventually built a movement that did contribute, and we could argue about this forever, to the ending of the Vietnam War with a variety of tactics, many of them, most of them, actually, when you look at the picture, nonviolent. The campaign to close Guantanamo started in 2006 after we had some wonderful legal people working like Joe. It has grown tremendously, and there will be, we hope, 1,000 people circling the White House on the 11th, and there have been tremendous actions here too. So I guess the reason I did that little historical thing is to remind us that people start small. If you thought Occupy was big this summer, wait till next spring. So Joe, could you kind of summarize what's going to happen in Chicago in the next couple?
So we've passed out a few flyers, and you're really all invited to take part. And after I summarize what's happening here that you can participate in, I want to take a moment to just add something that was brought out earlier about talking to your friends and your family, your kids, your grandkids. I have a personal story I'd like to share with you. The orange flyer that you have principally focuses on the January 11th action down at Federal Plaza, and it's going to be at 3 p.m., and there'll be about 10 speakers who are going to speak about this whole sweep of types of detention that this government is relying on these days. Please join us, and we will be having a group of people in orange jumpsuits, and there will be an action in front of the federal courthouse. We're going to keep it to a short period because it could be a cold day on Wednesday, but it would be a wonderful day to be out there. As Rosalie mentioned, there are vigils also taking place. The two things that I would call to your attention, tomorrow, if you're available, you might want to go to Wellington Avenue, UCC. That's at Wellington down at Broadway in Chicago. They're having a special service that is addressing this whole issue of detention and torture. It's a great place to get together with like-minded folks. At 1 o'clock, there's going to be a training session in nonviolent resistance, and then at 5 o'clock a specific planning meeting around actions on January 11th. A second flyer that we passed out deals with January 14th, a week from today, and I invite you to mark your calendars and be sure to come down to this event at Loyola Law down in downtown. Andy Worthington, who is, I think, the premier authority outside of the realm of law and actually the universities. He is an independent reporter who has been working on these issues and getting the word out year after year after year on Guantanamo. He will be there, and he will be hosting a screening of his film called Outside the Law. So it is his first time ever to be in Chicago. World Can't Wait is hosting that together with a number of groups at Loyola. Please try to be there. It's going to be a kind of a really special event. Another action that I can tell you about is that on Thursday, November 12th, we haven't talked about this here today, but there is a resolution before the City Council introduced by Alderman Joe Moore to declare Chicago a torture-free city. And I'm going to just state briefly that it is in response to the Burge torture cases, police torture. It is addressing the issue of solitary confinement as torture. It is addressing the role of Chicago as a haven for people from around the world who have been subjected to torture in their own countries, who come here for treatment. It is very important for us to have a turnout so that our aldermen see that we are serious about this and we want this thing passed. And part of it has to do with what we do going forward into the spring as we have people from around the world coming to Chicago. We want this resolution passed, so please join us for that. And finally, I'll mention that there will be a hearing next Tuesday on these new ordinances that are intended to quash dissent and free expression in Chicago. Again, we need everybody to come out for these and say, we're not standing for this. It's not just the usual suspects. It's not just a few anti-war types. Everybody wants to be able to speak in the city of Chicago. So these are all things for you to participate in. And I'll just take a moment to refer to a story. I was talking to my mom about a year ago, shortly before she passed away, and we were watching a lot of videos together. And we watched a video called The Great Dictator by Charlie Chaplin. And has anybody here seen this film, The Great Dictator? And it's really quite phenomenal because one of the things that it shows is that at a time when terrible things were happening in another part of the world, there was full knowledge of what was going on. It was not something that was hidden from anybody. Anybody who wanted that information could have it. And this was a time in my mom's life when I knew it was sort of my last chance to find out some things about our family. And I was talking to her a lot about things like when she was first married and stuff. My father came from a newspaper reporting family. His father was an old, crusty newspaper editor in New Jersey who his big moment was when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped. So that'll tell you how far back that goes. And I said, Mom, when you were first with Dad's family in New Jersey in the early 40s, and Grandpa Scary was, he knew everybody in the world of public affairs, what were you saying about this stuff that was going on in Europe? And she said, nobody was talking about it. Nobody was talking about it. And that really has haunted me ever since. And so the thing that I took away from that is don't let this be the time when people leave saying, huh, this was going on and nobody was talking about it. You go home, you get on the phone to your family and your friends, you talk to your grandchildren and your children, and you tell them to get out there at these demonstrations, and if you can, you be with them too. So thank you for being here today.
Have there been repercussions against the lawyers for representing the Guantanamo prisoners?
I refuse to refer to them as Henry Confidants. I call them prisoners anyway. You guys are courageous and fearless, but have there been repercussions? You're really wondering about this. Have you been threatened?
Do you want to?
Why don't you? Because he's been doing it much longer than me, and you would know.
The short answer to your question is no. When we first filed at Rasul, which was the first case that got underway, and we filed in February of 2002, so it's coming up on 10 years now, one of my co-counsel, who was based in New Orleans, received a death threat at home when his name appeared in the paper. I've never received anything like that. The closest I've ever, what I do get when my name appears in the paper now and again associated with the representation of one person or another, angry emails. Sometimes they will veer slightly towards threatening stuff, but ordinarily it's people like you that blah, blah, blah. I will tell you that the thing that has always been the most personally painful to me are the emails I get from people who accuse me of being a bad Jew. I'm a bad Jew. Yeah. I'm a bad Jew. From other Jews. Who accused me of being a bad Jew for doing this work. And how were you raised, friend? How were you? You just want them to study history more. But I get those a fair amount.
Several times you referred to they when referring to the people who make decisions in Guantanamo or how the law is utilized. Can you tell me who the they is? I mean, the government is made up of people. It's not just a virtual force. It's made up of people. Do we have currently our society under the domination of paranoid schizophrenics? Is there a deep psychological crisis that's going on? It's more than just neoliberalism and individualism. Could you give some color to that question?
I'm not sure I can. All I'm really referring to is this is what everyone here understands intuitively, which is the space, the fissure, the chasm that divides the sense of local voice and public policy. I mean, everyone perceives that as a yawning gulf, and that gives rise to the sensation, the sentiment that they are not responsive and not who we are. That is, at a sort of formal level, not true, because we have these things called elections, which are meant to establish a connection and to create a voice and blah, blah, blah. But everybody knows, or ought to know by now, that that is a very imperfect method of communicating desires. What works, really, is creating the sense that a limited number of people can do that we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And if you really do create that sense, a small number of people can have an extraordinary impact. I mean, as evidenced by, the gun lobby. I mean, that's... That's not millions and millions of people, but it has the effect as though it were.
This kind of follows up on a previous question. I've been reading a book about what happened after the 1973 coup against Allende,
right.
And the lead up to it is just terrifyingly close to what's happening here. There was a huge division in the country. There was a feeling of absolute hatred of one side of the country, which was more liberal, and the other side of the country that thought that they were ruffians and going to threaten the security of the country. The tension had been building up and building up and building up. And then after it happened, of course, there was this horrible period of torture. And it seemed as though some of the forces that allowed that to happen were a collusion of different forces. There were the businessmen from the U.S. who were just wanted to get Allende out. I mean, they didn't care about the torture later. They overlooked it. there were the landowners in the country who wanted to, you know, hold on to their power, and there was the military who had this attitude that you pointed out earlier, that these people are a threat, and whatever we do to them, they deserve it. So my question to you is, what is your take on that? Where do you see us in relation to what happened to Chile?
You know, I think that the study of international events and sort of a comparative analysis is always extraordinarily valuable. But I, in many ways, I don't think something like that would happen here, because as polarized as you perceive the country to be, the most polling data shows that the polarization is only at the poles, the extremes, the ends, and that the great majority of folks in the middle approach this issues like this with yawning indifference. And there are vastly more people who watch American Idol every week, if it's on every week, than they do, you know, presidential debates. The great majority of American people are simply asleep. And that's what prevents the sort of extreme polarization that leads to massive social dislocation. It also means, however, that policy is shaped by very, very small numbers on either end. If polling data and anecdotal data can be trusted, the reality is that the polarization you perceive is for a relatively not insignificant and certainly larger than it used to be, but still a small fraction of the population, political polarization. Most people just don't care.
Usually we don't ask, we go to the root why these things happen in Afghanistan or other places, or we don't ask questions. Like suddenly the media and president and Congress, they say Americans owe $14 trillion. And nobody asks to whom we owe and when we owe this money. What happened? Why we didn't know before? You know, and actually $14 trillion, those that we owe, where did they storage them? You know? Or it is just from out of thin air they made us owe. Actually, we don't owe nobody. In Afghanistan, during the war with Russia, I saw there was a huge place, maybe a million people who were there, and there was a platform, and there were a bunch of American officials like Senator Edward Kennedy, and others, and I hear that he was telling the Afghanis people that your war is our war against these godless colonies and this and that, and giving a lot of promises to them. Then I seen on TV over here from American TVs that the Mujahideen of Afghanis went to a power plant, at least multi-billion dollars, and destroyed. That time, they lost my support. And I saw bridges that they were destroying between two mountains. And years later, I saw a very old Afghani person, and I said, why you did that? You trash your own country. He said that the American told us, if you don't destroy these bridges and power plant, the Russians don't go. If you don't, you can't believe that how much advances American technology to Russia. When the Russians left, we're gonna bring millions of technicians and engineers to build the country. He said, but when the war was over, the Russian left, and they said, oh, give us all of the advanced missiles, this, that we gave you. We are leaving and you go home. He said, what, we trash our country? When your technician and engineer is gonna come? And they said, we lied to you.
We're nearing the end of our time, and I don't want to stop anybody, but we're losing our audience. And I just want to know really quickly, how many people found out about this through the library website or through the library? Could you just raise your hand? How many people found out through one of the flyers that you saw around town? How many people found out on a website? I put it on a 5 or 6 websites. Gosh, it's about even.
How about
email? Emails, websites, neighbors. Okay, so there's... Yeah, well, there's no consensus, so I guess we keep doing what we've been doing. And I didn't want to cut out thing, but I just knew people were starting to leave. So thank you very much. We can go back to questions.
Do everything.
Not so much a question as a very quick comment. I am 64, among the gray-haired league. One of the things that I have noticed in the talk about who's supposed to be out on the street, as we say, where are the young people? Frankly, I think, where are the retired people? Because, in fact, we enjoy several advantages that the young folks don't. A properly trained government employee of a military background could, without doubt, render me a corpse or a mewling mass of misery in about 30 seconds, but so could a stroke, and so could a heart attack. So, if something happens to us, is it that much different than what's going to happen in a few years anyway? A young person or a younger person with family has responsibilities for things like mortgages and children's education. I happen to be single. I don't have those. A young person may fear that their career, if they even have a job, would be trashed. If you're a retiree, you don't have that constraint. Therefore, it seems to me that the leading edge of this take it to the streets, in fact, jolly well ought to be those of us over the age of 60 who don't look good. It does not look good for a policeman to be beating us over the head, my God. You know, it's somebody's grandmother, they're beating someone's grandmother. The kids are more apt to be abused, the kids are more apt to be arrested, okay? The kids are going to have fewer resources. So my message to myself and to all the rest of us is, well, if people need to get out on the streets, how about us?
I'm wondering if I could get from either of you the a sense of the context in which all this sort of draconian change in our civil society is taking place, being the global economic system, its collapse, the fact that the U.S. military functions as a key fixture in global economics, global capitalism, also the impending crisis of the here and now crisis of environmental change, and how this might be affecting the reach to greater control of civil society as well as the world at large by that tiny class that makes the decisions that make sure the Pentagon is funded, make sure that the weapons are produced, make sure that banks are bailed out as the rest of us are left to fend for ourselves.
I guess I'll just make one quick comment, and it sort of ties into what you were saying about Chile, is that I do see in my work, I represent a lot of indigent people, I do see the middle class in this country, we are losing it. Millions of people in the last few years have lost their homes and have slipped from middle class into lower class. And when that happens, historically, societies do become unstable. And so, and there is a tendency to turn towards police state mentalities. So that's really my only comment. I don't know if Joe wants to.
You know,
It's very interesting. That's not inevitable, though. And, you know, the last time we had a real sort of communitarian spirit and the sense that we were all in this boat together was during the Depression. One of the reasons for that is that the Depression rendered impossible the myth that poverty is a product of individual failure. That is, you are poor because you are undeserving, which is a very deep-rooted individualistic myth in the United States. But if poverty is widespread and you become impoverished, well, you are always the person who said they are impoverished. And if it now is affecting you, then you suddenly rethink and reconceive that myth. And you no longer think of poverty as something that afflicts people who are deserving. It now afflicts people who are undeserving. And it was that sentiment that the New Deal captured in, now it was never complete, right? It was always, there was still terrible Jim Crow. So I don't want to make any sort of like, you know, mythical representations about what the New Deal and the Roosevelt administration was. But it was much more of a communitarian spirit and a sense of civic virtue. Right, and that's where Social Security comes from. Right, you had a very different sense of what the relationship between the government and the people was supposed to be. It is at least theoretically possible that one thing that could come out of this economic crisis is a sense that, you know, we really are all in this together. And it is not just them folk, poor, undeserving folk, to whom this happens. And but again, all these different options are fought for in the public square. It is a matter of a message catching the wind of broad social forces and prevailing in the sort of give and take of public debate. So it can't happen unless people are writing about it and speaking about it and clamoring for it.
You want to take a couple more questions?
Whatever people want.
Do we have more questions out there? Back there.
Thank you. In regard to communitarian spirit, I'm from Iran. There's those of us here who show solidarity with the American people in regard to what's happening here, encroachment on civil liberties and all that. We show somebody and we do participate in demonstrations and all that. But at the same time, I just saw a button, no war on Iran, which of course we're against any kind of aggression internationally from American side, from any other imperialist countries. At the same time, we actually need that the progressive American community show their sympathy and their solidarity with the people in Iran, Chile, and many other countries. We have police state in Iran. It was at the time of Shah, worse than that, right now, under the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have thousands who are being executed. And we need this international spirit, international community, communitarian spirit. So we like to basically cover everything in totality of it. When we like, you know, we come here, we show sympathy with you. Yes, there are some encouragement and about civil liberties, and we're going to fight for it. We show sympathy to you. But much worse than that is going on in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Iran, and all that. So I thought maybe you could speak to this.
Well, you know, it's interesting. What you describe, and someone was talking about, Joe was talking about the failure to make observations, the failure to object when totalitarianism was taking hold prior to and during World War II. It's actually related to what you say, because it was that experience. It was the awareness that the information was there to know what Hitler represented long before we entered the war, long before. And a very interesting study is of just sort of the U.S. refusal to see, I mean, just the persistent refusal to see what was going on. And one of the representations that was made to justify that refusal was, this is a domestic German affair. The Germans sort out their own problems. And it was a reaction against that obvious failure after World War II that stimulated the rise of international human rights law. It was the idea that, no, certain behavior is the world's problem. And that sentiment is really what you're trying to tap into in the condemnation of what's happening in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Iran. It is not one that encourages imperialism. It is not one that encourages military encroachments, but it's one that encourages universal human rights norms. And I agree with that entirely.
But what about this right to intervene that we just saw in Libya, where under the pretext of saving Libyans, NATO spent 3 months bombing them and creating massive infrastructure damage, as well as fueling a civil war now?
And then we do what our friend here was talking about, is that once you create that chaos, you have solved the country's problem and you'll abandon it, which is what happened in Afghanistan after the end of the war against the Soviets, which we funded to an enormous amount. Ronald Reagan referred to the Mujahideen as freedom fighters. They are God-fearing freedom fighters. You know, that's what we do.
So I might also comment that when we intervene, supposedly on the side of the freedom fighters, and we make a mess of the country with sanctions and whatever, we, instead of encouraging the middle class and the freedom in the country, we consolidate the terrorism from the top down. This is what happened in Germany. I mean, it wasn't that Hitler just popped up out of nowhere. The economy was destroyed. Mm-hmm. Why was the economy destroyed? Look at that bit of history. And why will the economy potentially be destroyed in Iran? We're having a lot to do with that. The more we destroy that economy, the worse we make things for the Iranians.
So I want to add a comment around the last couple of questions. The gentleman talking about Iran, let me amplify a little bit about what's happening with the No Iran War movement. Thanks, Lynn. As an illustration of how you are the answer. So we have opinions up here, and some other people have opinions, but you are the answer. So there's a group of which I think Neighbors for Peace is a constituent member called the Midwest Anti-War Mobilization that tries to do things in the larger Chicago community. And we organized the march on October 8th, dealing with Afghanistan. We are working to promote the January 11th event. And one of the recent events was that somebody said, look, there's this brewing U.S. threat against Iran and against Syria, so we must get people to understand that we need to resist the idea that the U.S. goes in and attacks. There was debate on this within this kind of small group of people who are very actively involved, a lot of questions, some of the specific questions that you raised. And so as a first step, we said, okay, well, let's have a resolution that if unprovoked, there should be no attack, and let's start talking to a lot of other people about that. And so that has then led to some further conversations. Now, just last night, I was down at Occupy Chicago, where we have put that resolution in front of them. And they said, okay, you know, it's looking like they'll probably vote to pass that tonight, but somebody said, why are we just passing somebody else's resolution? Shouldn't we have a working group on this? And I think that's exactly what needs to happen. And then another thing that they did is they said, let's have a teach-in about this whole Libya and NATO question. And then I said to them, you know, I've met somebody from Syria, and now I've met somebody from Iran who wants to raise this question, yes, but under what circumstances will humanitarian intervention take place? What would be right and what not? how, okay, they said, great, we could have a whole seminar on Libya, Syria, Iran, and exactly this question, if we can get people to participate. I said, well, I think it's looking like we can get people to participate. So in very large, to a very large extent, you are the answer. And what Joe was saying, that this has to be constantly debated in the public square in order for us to carry it to a point where it's being executed properly by the people who work for us. And that is what I refer to as the importance of the streets. And when you look at these ordinances that are being put forth by the mayor of Chicago, please let there be no mistake. The streets is not a place where violence happens unless the police come to cause the violence. The streets is a place where something much more threatening happens. It's where citizens talk to each other. It's where we talk to each other, you talk to each other. It's where the conversation is happening. It's not happening online. It's not happening at cocktail parties. It's not happening where you talk to the people that you always talk to. It's where you meet your fellow citizens that you don't often compare ideas with. And it's exhilarating and it's very threatening to the people sitting in the seat of government. And so they want to make it loud and clear that you should stay away from those streets. They do not want any of this talking going on. So I leave it to you to think about what to do about that.
Our last question, and I just have to say that it's in the streets that you break down the stereotypes that are used to keep us separated and afraid, and discover that the person that you might feel somewhat intimidated by or cross the street to stay away from has the capacity to express ideas of understanding and philosophical take on contemporary life that would make you marvel at what your own ideas lack, or at least complement what you have to say about what brings you out to that moment to begin with. Go ahead with our last question.
In lieu of that statement, I wondered if there could be more communication, or maybe I'm missing some, between the seniors that are here and throughout the community and the Northwestern University students. How many of them are really interested and involved? And could we, instead of a dance, which I get involved with and is wonderful, have an outgrowth reach to bring us together on these issues?
I think that's a great idea. And as a member of the faculty at Northwestern, albeit at the law school, so which is removed from the Evanston campus, I would encourage that and try to help make that happen. I mean, the undergrads are who you're talking about, and they're up here, and so I'd have to reach out to folks here. But there really is a great deal of interest there, and it is a shame that we don't have that communities are separate, because there are people interested who are both young and less young.
Well,
okay. I want to thank you on behalf of Neighbors for Peace, the Evanston Public Library, the producers of The Response. Mr. Margulis, thank you very much, and Mr. Goodman, who's already left, thank you for your time, and Occupy Chicago, and Occupy Evanston, and occupy our lives. For the longest time, we've been told to disoccupy the reality of being alive in the moment, being engaged. And I think given all the threats, all the forces that are marshaling themselves against our ability to sustain our humanity, we need to reoccupy our lives and accomplish many of the things that we've heard suggested today. So thank you again for coming out.